Hi there, I'm Stephen Bruce, and I'm bringing you the podcast version of another of our research reviews. These research reviews are provided to us courtesy of the Research Review Service, and this one was conducted by Dr. Dimitri Asimakopoulos. The title of the review is Frozen Shoulder Contracture Syndrome, Etiology, Diagnosis and Management, and it was published in Manual Therapy, and the author was Jay Lewis of the University of Hertfordshire. Bit of background information. Frozen Shoulder Contracture Syndrome, or FSCS, has been long studied, dating back to 1896, when Duplay coined the term periarthrite scapular humeral. There have been many theories regarding its etiology, and frustratingly so, its treatment. Some attributed it to an inflammation of the subacromial bursa, periarthritis and non-calcifying tendinitis of the rotator cuff. Later on, the term adhesive capsulitis was coined, as scientists visualised inflammation, fibrosis and contraction of the shoulder capsule, with the axillary fold becoming adhered to the humeral head. The terms primary, idiopathic and secondary, trauma or forced inactivity due to trauma, were proposed in 2011, and these can be further subcategorised into intrinsic, extrinsic and systemic categories. Suffice it to say, there's been a lot of debate and misunderstanding surrounding this challenging clinical syndrome. This article describes what is known about the pathogenesis of this challenging condition and proposes some treatment strategies. The paper first looks at the pathogenesis of frozen shoulder and points out that the first sign is often a tremendous decrease in capsular volume, secondary to capsular restriction. There are a number of opinions as to why this occurs, namely inflammatory processes or a chronic inflammation with fibroplastic proliferation. In spite of this, histological studies have reported an insignificant number of inflammatory cells in affected capsular tissues. Histological and immunochemical sampling have found proliferation of contractile scar tissue. Some have also found an association between Propionibacterium acnes infection and frozen shoulder. So here are some of the known elements of frozen shoulder. First, a thickening and fibrosis of the rotator interval, bordered medially by subscapularis and laterally by the supraspinatus tendon, with the biceps tendon in the middle. There's obliteration and scarring of the subscapular recess, that's the area between biceps and subscapularis, and there's neovascularity. There's increased cytokine concentrations, and there's capsular contraction, namely anterior and inferior aspects of the capsule. There's reduced joint volume, and there's contraction and fibrosis of the coracohumeral ligament. There's a contractile protein presence, and fibroblast and myofibroblast proliferation. It's interesting to note that adhesion of the capsule to the humeral head does not occur. And people who develop frozen shoulder after shoulder surgery have greater concentrations of substance P compared to those who don't. Going one step further, substance P has been reported to accelerate angiogenesis and hypercellularity in the tendons. Interleukins, which have also been shown to promote angiogenesis, have been shown in the glenohumeral capsule and subacromial bursa in people with frozen shoulder. And knowing this, targeted neovascularity may help in the treatment of the condition. Looking at the epidemiology and the history, current evidence suggests that frozen shoulder occurs in about 2 to 5% of the population. Still, its actual prevalence is uncertain, probably due to underreporting. The most well-known risk factors are diabetes, family history, genetic predisposition, hypothyroidism, and possibly ethnicity. And I suppose frozen shoulder is best known to pass through three stages: the frozen and painful stage, freezing and stiffness, and then finally the thawing and recovery stage, with the average duration being just over 30 months. Still, some pain and disability might be present up to 7 years post-onset, with the average being about 4.4 years. In terms of diagnosis, there's no gold standard for frozen shoulder. It's typically diagnosed via thorough clinical examination, exclusion of other pathologies, and normal shoulder radiographs. Clinically, there should be a pattern of progressively restricted joint movement attributed to capsular restriction. The simplest clinical diagnostic criteria are equal restriction of active and passive shoulder external rotation, with an essentially normal radiograph. Neovascularity has been visualised inside the rotator interval, but requires further research. So turning to management, frozen shoulder is often classified based on a three-stage model, as mentioned above, the freezing, frozen and thawed stages. This particular author simplifies this a little bit, dividing patients into two general camps. First, those with more pain than stiffness, those in the early stages, and second, those with more stiffness than pain, which is the later stages. Typically, the first stage of treatment in all cases is patient education. Patients will naturally have questions, and we should be able to provide them with realistic answers. Prior treatment recommendations have included supervised neglect, suggesting this condition would recover with no intervention. And although not necessarily incorrect, most patients are unwilling to wait an average of 30 plus months for this to occur. As with most musculoskeletal conditions, a variety of treatment options exist for frozen shoulder. Unfortunately, the literature to date is far from conclusive. Joint mobilization and manipulation, both high and low grade in all directions, are popular and potentially they are effective options. When combined with exercise, joint mobilizations have been associated with better outcomes compared to ultrasound and massage. However, many of the clinical studies on manual mobilization and manipulation published to date lack adequate control groups or generally have small sample sizes in their study groups. There is some research to suggest that shortwave diathermy combined with stretching is superior to superficial heating and stretching, and to stretching alone. The effectiveness for acupuncture therapies remains contentious, with some evidence showing moderate short-term benefit in combination with exercise. However, the evidence remains overwhelmingly equivocal. Also not definitive is the literature pertaining to corticosteroid injection, which may reduce pain and improve function in the short term. There's some suggestion that the benefits of guided corticosteroid injections may be enhanced when combined with physiotherapy. Hydrodistension of the articular capsule followed by physical therapy after the procedure has been reported by some groups to have positive effects. However, more research is needed to substantiate this. Manipulation under anaesthetic and exercise has not shown better clinical outcomes in comparison to physiotherapy alone. And of course, manipulation under anaesthetic is not without its own risks. Hemarthrosis, slap lesions, partial thickness tear of subscapularis, osteochondral defects and labral detachment have all been reported in the literature. In the UK, treatment of frozen shoulder occurs along the following lines. Diagnosis through an equal limitation of internal and external rotation with normal radiograph. The patient can then follow a wait-and-see approach with home-based therapy, clinically based physiotherapy, referral for an orthopaedic opinion or a combination of injection and physiotherapy. Clinician-assisted mobilizations are usually in the AP direction or AP while they perform passive external rotation with the assistance of a dowel, and there are photographs of this on the paper on the website. Mobilizations into shoulder internal rotation by placing the upper limb at the end of the hand behind the back range and can be combined with traction using a belt or towel tied behind the therapist, and this also is shown on one of the photographs on the website. And then there's proprioceptive neuromuscular facilitation, which can be utilised to address movement and motor control coordination. So looking at the clinical application of all this, pain and functional movement restriction of the shoulder associated with frozen shoulder generally improves over time. However, pain-free range of motion might not be achieved in all individuals. They need to be patient and reassured that in time, with great passive and active care, their pain will decrease and their function will increase. It's important for the clinician to physically mobilise the shoulder capsule and tell the patient that they're expected to perform exercises consistently at home. It's also important to tell your patients the treatment of this syndrome is like a marathon, not a sprint. It will take time. So looking at how this study was conducted, this was actually a clinical commentary, so there were no statistical methods or any rigorous search strategy performed during the process itself. There are, of course, strengths and weaknesses. And looking at the strength, the author has provided the reader with a very balanced opinion of the evidence, such as it is, both orthopaedic and conservative. He chose to avoid stating his own opinion and stuck to the evidence, with the exception of describing how the programme he's presumably involved in the UK is used to treat frozen shoulder. He also provided the reader with information regarding where more research needs to be performed. In terms of weaknesses, the author has picked each and every article included in this commentary himself, and he hasn't included his inclusion criteria, which leads to to the possibility, of course, of significant bias. And it's notable that excluded from his references are any of the papers concerning the Simeon Neil Asher treatment of frozen shoulder, which we've discussed at length on our website. The author has also provided us with his interpretation of the data, and he didn't supply any statistical measures to his interpretation. So there you are, the podcast version of yet another of the research review papers provided to us courtesy of the Research Review Service. I hope that's useful. Interpretation of the data, and he didn't supply any statistical measures to his interpretation. So there you are, the podcast version of yet another of the research review papers provided to us courtesy of the Research Review Service. I hope that's useful.